content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine.
The gift of her brief, beautiful time on earth over the tragedy of her death. We are in awe of this mother's strength and generosity as she shares Penny's story to raise awareness of neurofibromatosis, the most common gene disorder, and spread her legacy of love and light. From the moment Penny was born, we knew she was special, but her true life's journey began when she was just 4 months old. She rolled off our bed and fractured her tibia. Quickly, that went from what we thought was just a broken leg to what we learned was something called congenital pseudoarthrosis, which falls under the umbrella of neurofibromatosis, or NF. We had never heard of it, but it turns out that 1 out of 2,500 kids are afflicted with NF, which makes it the most prominent genetic condition in the United States. When Penny rolled off the bed, that was the minute that changed everything for me. I immediately thought, okay, we're being tested, and it's up to us to determine how we're going to play these cards we've been dealt. At just 18 months old, Penny had the first of 14 different procedures and surgeries to correct her tibia and remove NF1 tumors that grew in her body. She wore a bright pink body cast, bedazzled with stones, for 4 months, and would commando crawl across the room like a true warrior. Once the cast came off, she never let a day go by without living it to the fullest. Penny wore a protective brace on her leg her entire life, but it never defined her. I think it became invisible to her friends because they saw her for who she was, which was this bright, beautiful, joyous spirit. Throughout her life, she did everything her friends were doing, from ice skating to gymnastics to wearing high heels to going to dances as a teenager. She would always accessorize her brace to match her outfit. It became part of her in the most beautiful way. In September 2020, when Penny was 14, we noticed that she had a bit of a wandering eye, so we took her to the ophthalmologist, who said that it could be due to kids staring at screens so much during COVID. We decided to get her an MRI to be safe. That was the first time that we saw a tumor, and she had the first of 7 brain surgeries that transpired over the course of 2 years. In spring of 21, when Penny was 15, we learned that the benign tumor had turned malignant. But again, as with her brace, nothing stopped Penny. Brain surgeries, radiation treatment, chemotherapy, it all became part of her daily routine. She would schedule her proton radiation treatments very early in the morning so we could commute from Long Island to the proton treatment center in New York City, do her 20-minute blast, get in the car, and head back so she could run the camp she and her friends held for 5 to 7-year-old girls in the neighborhood. My husband Chad and I would have moments of frustration where our patience was being tested, waiting, waiting, waiting. There's so much waiting in hospitals. But over the next year and a half, Penny never faltered. We would look at her and be like, how can we even contemplate complaining when she's the one being poked and prodded? Not only was she getting treatment, but she also refractured her tibia. On Halloween night last year, she was on crutches and in a boot, but she went trick-or-treating with a bunch of her girlfriends dressed as an angel. 3 days later, she went into the hospital. The tumor had progressed very quickly. In that first week in November, we recognized there wasn't more that could be done. We decided to bring her home. From a very early age, Penny would find beauty in imperfection and positivity in the face of any challenge, and choose faith over fear. So we decided, okay, we are going to continue living life in the most positive way possible. People would come to see Penny in her bed, and she had her dogs and her best friends and family with her. We would laugh and argue over whether we were going to play Yacht Rock or my husband's favorite radio station. We filled the space with music and so much love and light. People who were with us during that time referred to the house as this beacon of love. The afternoon when Penny passed, we had about 30 people over. We were upstairs having a quiet moment with Penny and her brothers, Henry and Frankie. The boys left, and Chad and I were with Penny when she passed. It was the most beautiful, warm November afternoon, and two friends of ours were walking around the yard when they saw this incredible light on the window of Penny's room, and they took a picture. When we all were together inside, they showed it to us. The timestamp was 2:15, the exact time that Penny had passed. The unbelievable thing is not only the light in the window, there's also the light in the shape of a cross or what looks like an angel reflected on the driveway. For our family, that was a sign that now Penny is so much bigger than life. There's so much that we can learn from her, and the beauty of that will continue past her physically being here. After Penny passed, we held a celebration of her life. We told everyone there's going to be no black. We wanted people to wear color and to celebrate Penny. 1,100 people came out. During the celebration, there were butterflies everywhere. Someone said that the butterfly represents an inextinguishable life, always drawn to the light. And that, to us, is so Penny. The butterfly spreading its wings, the freedom in their flight, so reflect and represent Penny's own life. The celebration was on a Friday, and on Monday morning, my husband and I woke up, looked at each other, and were like, we need to do something in Penny's name to honor her legacy. There's such an incredible lesson that Penny has taught us all about finding beauty in imperfection and positivity in the face of challenge. She taught us that, as with butterflies, it's your wingspan, not your lifespan, that matters. It's the people you touch. Penny lived a greater life in her 16 years than so many people do in 100 years. We decided to launch Penny's Flight Foundation to tell Penny's story, spread her light, and raise awareness and critical funds for NF research. There really has not been so much focus on NF, which is caused by a genetic mutation, because there are so many different possible symptoms and conditions under the NF umbrella. For instance, you could have cafe au lait colored spots on your skin or the bowing of a long bone, congenital pseudoarthrosis. You can have optic tumors that lead you to go blind. You can have, in the very rare case, which is what Penny had, these malignant brain tumors. It varies from patient to patient, which makes it a tricky condition and hard to pinpoint. We launched Penny's Flight Foundation on a Thursday. That first weekend, Penny's friends, who go to different schools, launched pop-up events at their schools to raise awareness. In the first 2 weeks alone, we had 25 different pop-up activities. What I think has been the most incredible thing is that all these people we don't know are now saying, we want to get involved, how can we help? And so many families of NF warriors have come forward and said, thank you for shining a light on this somewhat unknown condition. Penny lived her life's purpose, and she was such a gift to me, my husband, and her brothers. Now it's up to us to continue that legacy, share her gifts, and help others. Editor's note. Loss touches everyone differently, and yet the experience is universal. Here are a few titles we turn to for solace and support in difficult times, and two, Angels in Our Midst and Healing from Loss, that Dorge and her family are finding helpful. Books on Loss. Notes on Grief by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. It's Okay That You're Not Okay by Megan Devine. The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, M.D. The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. Hello Grief by Alessandra Olenau. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. Angels in Our Midst by Anne H. Nielsen. And Healing After Loss, Daily Meditations for Working Through Grief by Martha W. Hickman. Our next article by Eleni N. Gage is titled, Questions to Ask Yourself Before Calling It. If you're stuck between a rock and a hard place in a relationship, take a deep breath and answer these. Number one, where do I draw the line? You may have your own personal threshold that, once crossed, means there's no going back. But beyond that, Genesis Games, a psychotherapist at Healing Connections in Miami, suggests these sub-questions. If you answer no to any of them, it's time to move on. Do I feel safe to voice my thoughts and feelings in this relationship? If not, have I felt this way before? Can I imagine myself feeling that way again? If trust is an issue, can it be rebuilt? If my partner did not change a thing about themselves, could I be happy with them? And here's a bonus point of no return question from certified relationship coach and host of the podcast Jillian on Love, Jillian Turecki. If I knew we could get the right help, would that even matter to me? If the answer is no, then put a fork in it. You're done. Number two, is this a roommate issue? Yes, it's frustrating when your other half leaves hair in the drain, pays the electric bill late, or forgets to take out the bins on trash day. But is it frustrating enough to dwarf all the reasons you love this person? Couples should not be stuck on roommate issues, says Games. Come to some form of consensus on them, it doesn't have to be perfect, and move on. Align chores with your individual strengths, ask them to set up reminders on their phone for recurring tasks, or stick a post-it on the mirror gently reminding them to wipe the basin. Set them up for success and don't sweat the small stuff. As for the big stuff, what Games calls multi-layered topics that are nuanced, religion, politics, money, family boundaries, communication, raising children, those fall into the category of relationship issues. These are more profound and usually don't have a resolution, she says. Our energy should be focused on understanding our relational issues and figuring out how to navigate these in the best way possible for all parties included. A lot of times, couples focus on roommate problems to avoid relational problems. Number three, have I asked for what I need? Turecki offers this question with an intriguing part two. Have I asked for what I need, or have I been resentful? Too often, we expect our partner to read our minds or intuit what we crave, whether that's a break from cooking every night or a sympathetic ear. Feeling hurt that our unspoken need isn't met, we then focus on their failure to please us, rather than what it is we actually want to happen. We reframe the situation as their character flaw, rather than our lack of communication, and resentment blooms. To counteract that tendency, John and Julie Schwartz Gottman, in their book The Love Prescription, recommend that we train ourselves to spell out what we need by describing our feelings, the situation, and what we'd like to happen, rather than saying anything about our partner. Instead of, "You're so selfish, I'm the one who does all the work around here," one could say, "I'm feeling so overwhelmed lately, and I'd love to cross making dinner off my list a few nights a week. Do you think you could cook or order in for us Tuesdays and Thursdays?" Making the issue about what you want rather than what's wrong with them is key. In a study of newlywed couples who were monitored over the course of 6 years, John Gottman found that he and his research partner, Sybil Carrere, could predict whether a couple would divorce or not with 96% accuracy based on the first 3 minutes of conversation they had during a conflict. The ones who ended up dissolving their partnerships introduced issues with global negative statements like "you always," "you never," or "you're so." Once you explain what you want, your partner has a chance to please you, you get the opportunity to be grateful, and a cycle of positive feeling starts. If you find that your partner refuses to meet your spoken needs again and again, then you've got a decision to make. But at least you know that you're dealing with someone who has chosen to ignore your desires, rather than a partner whose only real crime is not being telepathic. Number four, am I rooting for the relationship or for myself? It's human nature to want the last word, but if you live by that philosophy, that final word might be goodbye. When we're in a disagreement, we often go into sort of a lawyer mode, says social psychologist Richard Slatcher, director of the Close Relationship Lab at the University of Georgia. You never want to do that in a relationship. You want the relationship to win, not for you to win, to come to a resolution where both of you feel satisfied with the outcome. Try to give your partner the same benefit of the doubt you give a stranger on the street who bumped into you, that they might be clumsy or distracted, but they weren't intentionally trying to hurt you. Ask yourself, am I polite with this person? Am I kind to them? Suggests Slatcher. Yes, they are the person we trust to see us at our worst, but we really should be treating our partners better than anybody else, or at least striving to, he says. As you're putting the relationship first, be open to acknowledging when they are too. What feels to you like an attack or criticism, "I'd like us to spend more time staring at each other than at our phones," may actually be an insight that can leave the relationship stronger if you hear and respond to it. Number 5, do I really, really, really want to make it work? This is a question both you and your partner need to be answering with a resounding yes. If one of you doesn't, says Slatcher, it's going to be fruitless no matter what you do. Or, as Sharon Salzberg, a Buddhist teacher and author of the upcoming Real Life, The Journey from Isolation to Openness and Freedom, puts it, the most crucial question is to ask yourself if you want to have these kinds of conversations anymore. Am I willing to continue putting in the effort and intention to grow with this person? Once you've established that you both have the desire to fix things, then it's a matter of finding the right tools to do so, starting with the other questions above. Number 6, have I done everything I can? Everything, in Slatcher's view, includes trying to figure out if there is an external root cause to the deterioration of the relationship, say, terrible work stress. One might need the guiding hand of a therapist to figure that out, he adds. Ask yourself if, at one point, I was deeply in love with this person and wanted to be with them, have I done everything to try to figure out what it is that's changed and why? What happens if you've identified problems, both external and internal, sought solutions, worked on your communication, proceeded with kindness, put the relationship first, sought therapy, and it's still not working? If at the end of the day you really feel that you've given it your best effort, says Slatcher, then you can feel good about ending your relationship. Our next article by Julia Cameron is titled, This Powerful, Simple Practice Will Connect You to the Divine. The author of The Artist's Way shares a morning activity that will swing open an inner door. Although we tend to think of writing in secular terms, it is actually a spiritual path. We can consciously invite spiritual guidance. A simple prayer is relevant. Okay, God, you take care of the quality, I'll take care of the quantity. When I was first told this prayer, I thought it was far-fetched. I had trouble believing that the spirit of the universe could take an interest in my prose. But as I retired from my ego's need to be a brilliant author, my writing became more clear. No longer aimed at being impressive and brilliant, it aimed instead to be forthright. I came to believe that creator was another word for artist. I trusted the great artist, in the words of Dylan Thomas, the force that through the green fuse drives the flower. I tried to think of myself like a flower, mysteriously blooming. I tried to be humbly obedient. I came to believe that honesty and authenticity could capture my reader's faith. As a writer, I credit my daily practice of morning pages with giving me the willingness to start where I am. What precisely are morning pages? They are 3 daily pages of longhand writing that is strictly stream of consciousness. Writing morning pages is like sending a telegram to the universe. We give our precise coordinates, here and how I am. The universe, in response, acts on our behalf. Although we may not call it that, we have sent a prayer. Implicit in each day's pages is the request, please help me, and the universe does. Writing pages, we dare to mention our dreams. The universe acts on those dreams, giving us what we need, if not what we want. At their root, morning pages are a prayer petition. We ask the universe for our dreams, wants, and needs, and the universe complies with our requests. We are met more than halfway by a benevolent something that we may hesitate to call God. Although we may be reluctant to name it, spirituality is afoot. Our pages symbolize our willingness to talk to and hear from God. Writing pages, we swing open an inner door. In our imagination, we read an inscription. This is the way to a faith that works. Morning pages, too, work. As we clarify on the page our yearnings, those yearnings begin to be met. As one practitioner told me, I'm a Jew and an atheist, hardly your target audience, but pages work for me. What do we mean by pages work? What we are talking about is nothing less than a spiritual awakening. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life shifts. Where before the world was forbidding, it comes now to be benevolent. We meet with ease situations that used to baffle us. Over time, we recognize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? I don't think so. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They always materialize as we do the work of writing pages. Whether we conceive of pages as putting us in touch with a benevolent something, or we think that pages are themselves that something matters little, what counts is the daily practice, a form of meditation as well as prayer. I recently heard from a man who has been doing morning pages for 22 years. He is an atheist, and pages themselves are his higher power. He has written 13 movies, leading me to tell him, "You don't believe in God, but God clearly believes in you." Increased productivity is a common fruit of morning pages. As we work with the pages, we become more bold, taking risks as the pages urge, moving from project to project without excruciating pauses in between. As we learn to doubt our doubts, we expand, becoming larger and braver. Pages gives us a safety net. Our risks, once seeming too large, become smaller. After all, the pages catch us if we fall. They partner us. When we begin writing with where we are and how we feel in our morning pages, we are actually formulating a prayer. We are sending a telegram to the universe that says, "This is my precise place, and these are my precise feelings. Can you help me?" As we delineate our position, we are sending an SOS. We are saying exactly what we feel, and that is an invitation to the universe to intervene on our behalf. Writing on our creative projects later in the day, the same philosophy applies. Ours is a secular time, and we often fail to realize the power and potency of the written word as prayer. Putting pen to the page, listening for inspiration, we are uttering the perennial artist's prayer, "Please help me." It matters less sometimes what we write than that we write at all. Our words lead us to authenticity just as authenticity leads us to our words. As we describe our state with specificity, we are given the gift of humility, and from humility, great art is born. Consider the Mona Lisa, the precise rendering of an enigmatic smile. Writing carefully, we too render the enigma that is the human condition. Great art is born from the prayer, "Please help me render what I see and what I hear." My secular friends are astonished and even offended by my use of prayer in writing. Prayer works, I tell them, and as a working writer, I use anything that works. "But Julia," they exclaim, "isn't that cheating?" Once upon a time, I tell them everyone prayed. The inspiration for art routinely was ascribed to a higher power. In these modern times, we are reluctant to name God as our collaborator, and yet that is the experience of artists through the ages. As Brahms remarked, "Straight away the ideas flow into me directly from God." As William Blake remarked, "Not I, but the Holy Spirit does the work." All artists experience the spark of the divine. When we write humbly, we invite a flow of ideas not commonly our own. Listening to the thread of inspiration that leads us from one idea to the next, we often experience a sense of awe. It is as though we are fitting together a celestial puzzle, and as we place each thought on the page, we begin to see the form of what wants to be born. The experience of such inspiration is essentially an experience of grace. Divine ideas enter our thoughts. We take them down, but they lift us up. Writing a poem, I often experience wonder as the final line twists into view. Some of my finest writing comes as a sort of celestial joke. I find myself thinking, "Oh, that's what they were up to." By they, I mean what I call higher forces. As I write, I find myself guided. In days of yore, artists routinely cited celestial inspiration filling their work. In modern times, we speak less freely of the divine, yet its inspiration remains real, if only we open our hearts to it. As we ask the universe to lead us, we are led carefully and well. Many an artist, in a candid moment, will speak of the surprise that comes to them in their art. The brilliant landscape painter Jamie Kirkland says, "My paintings never turn out like they are in my head. Instead, they surprise me." Tasks. Number 1, morning pages. Every morning, set your alarm 30 minutes early and write longhand 3 8.5 by 11 inch pages about anything and everything that comes to mind. I always say I would never stand between anyone and their morning coffee, but try to get to the page as quickly as possible. Don't spend 45 minutes brewing the perfect cup. The faster you get to the page, the better the pages will work for you. Avoid the phone, computer, and email until you have finished your pages. They will act as windshield wipers, clearing away what stands between you and your day. Number 2, artist date. Once a week, block out approximately 2 hours to take your inner writer on a solo adventure. It need not be expensive. The point is that you are spending one-on-one time with your artist to do something festive and out of the ordinary. This is a tool of expansion. Used in conjunction with morning pages, you will find yourself in a flow of happy coincidences and good luck, which I like to call synchronicity. The artist date appears to take time, but it gives back energy and inspiration. Allow yourself to promise this date to your inner writer and keep it. Number 3, walks. Twice a week, or more often if you'd like to, take yourself on a solo, phone-free, dog-free, friend-free 20-minute walk. You may wish to walk out with a question. It is likely you will return with an answer. Walks will help you to metabolize this process, as well as provide inspiration and clarity in your writing. Number 4, the daily quota. Choose a low, doable daily quota for your writing project. For screenplays, I usually suggest 3 pages a day, for prose, 2. Choose a quota that is low enough that it feels easy within reach on a daily basis. In addition to writing your morning pages, you will hit your daily quota on your writing project every day. Number 5, writing stations. Choose a few locations in your house or in your neighborhood where you can write. It may be a favorite chair or corner of a table. It may be your home office. It may be a nearby coffee shop. The important point is that you find these locations comfortable and enticing to write. Check-in. Number 1, how many days did you do your morning pages this week? Are you able to get to them quickly and do them without interruption or distraction? Number 2, did you take your artist date? What was it? How was it? Did you experience synchronicity, optimism, or a sense of a benevolent higher power? All 3? Number 3, did you take your walks? Are you able to do them alone without distraction? Did you try walking out with a question and seeing if you returned home with an answer? And number 4, did you hit your daily quota? How many pages are you into your project? Do you feel a sense of excitement as you watch your page count building? Julia Cameron is the best-selling author of more than 40 books, fiction and nonfiction, a poet, songwriter, filmmaker, and playwright. Commonly referred to as the godmother or high priestess of creativity, her tools are based in practice, not theory, and she considers herself the floor sample of her own toolkit. The Artist's Way has been translated into 40 languages and has sold over 5 million copies to date. Our next article by Deborah Way is titled, Tove Ditlevsen's The Copenhagen Trilogy's prose is poetic, direct, and precise. Where reading is concerned, I'm often late to the party. Years and sometimes decades after everyone else has feasted on this or that novel or memoir or story collection, it will finally occur to me to pick it up. I like to read blue chip books. I like to feel like I discovered the book myself. This is why I seldom read beyond the headline of a review. E.L. Doctorow, Leslie Marmon Silko, Elena Ferrante, James Baldwin, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Ewan Apkin, the novels of Joyce Carol Oates, all were news flashes to me. Someday I might even roll the dice on Dickens. All this is to say how remarkable it is that I read the Copenhagen Trilogy the same year, 2021, that it was published in the U.S. More remarkably, I've just now read it again. It is that astonishing, the reigning favorite of all the books on my favorite shelf. If you've ever known a soul-deep feeling of estrangement, an existential otherness and aloneness, and isn't that more and more a condition of life today, I can't imagine a better book to read. In case you're not familiar with its history, it's a 3-part memoir by one of Denmark's most lionized writers, Tove Ditlevsen. The first 2 parts, Childhood and Youth, were originally published as individual volumes in Denmark in 1967. 4 years later came the 3rd, called Gift, a word that in Danish, depending on the context, can mean either poison or married. It's the part of the story in which Ditlevsen is both addict and wife. In the U.S. edition, this part is called Dependency. One of many things Ditlevsen does brilliantly is convey the way a young child makes sense of the world. Young Tove exists in a stream of consciousness, marked by the impressions of what happens to float past. Scraps of her mother's conversation, the comings and goings of neighbors she watches from her bedroom window, the beautiful picture of a happy family in a book. The picture is especially affecting because the world she's trying to make sense of happens to be brutal. Poverty, unemployment, the half-starvation you feel at the smell of dinner coming from the doors of the more well-to-do when for days you've been living on coffee and stale pastry. Alcoholism, scabies, husbands and wives who scorn and beat each other, parents who beat their children. But the harshest part of Tove's harsh world is her own emotionally stunted family. A mother who turns cold at will, who never touches her with love except once in an ambulance when Tove has diphtheria. A father who calls her a fool for wanting to be a poet. Tove's parents and brother unite in laughing at her feelings, especially her tears. And so she learns to keep her feelings and thoughts to herself. And so grows her feeling of difference, the feeling of being abnormal, other, isolated and disconnected. Regarding a girlhood friend, I'm always afraid of revealing myself. I'm afraid that she'll discover how I really am. Talking with other girls about marriage. I smile in agreement as if I'm also looking forward to such a future, and as usual, I'm afraid of being found out. I feel like I'm a foreigner in this world. Cheering the loudest at middle school graduations. It bothers me a lot that I don't seem to own any real feelings anymore, but I always have to pretend that I do by copying other people's reactions. Estrangement is both cause and effect. But if it's a source of pain, it's also a source of strength. Tove, the schoolgirl, hides herself behind a mask of stupidity, even as she considers herself a child genius. The language of poetry that flows through her separates her from her family in a way that gives her the ironclad determination to live on her own as soon as she's able. As a teenager and then a woman, her sense of singularity allows her to leave jobs, relationships, marriages that don't suit. I don't want anything to happen to me that I don't want. What she does want more than anything, even more than she wants to be normal, is to be a writer, and her alienation is in every way conducive. Tove is alienated from herself, meaning she can step outside herself to regard herself, her lifelong subject. It's as if all I can see in the whole world is myself. Detached as she is from other people, she feels no compunction about building her life around writing. And from an early age, she is a fabulist, untethered from and unbothered by the truth. She writes a poem and lies to her grandmother that it's a song she learned in school. When she starts middle school, she turns her father from a furnace stoker to a more impressive-sounding machinist. When she leaves school forever at age 14, there's no money for her to continue, she says goodbye to her teacher with easy fabrications about her rosy future. This isn't to say that Ditlevsen dissembles. Neither she nor anyone else in the trilogy is exempt from her unvarnished observations and assessments. Her prose, even when it's poetic, is spare, direct, precise. Her humor runs from dry to casually scathing. One evening, Nadja comes over dressed, as usual, as if she had just escaped a burning house. Her name is Edith Schnorr, and she lists from sheer self-importance. She serves up her own ingenuousness for amusement, as when she publishes her first poem in a literary journal. The next day, two copies of Wild Wheat arrive in the mail, and my poem is in both of them. Tove's perceptions, her inner world, the world of her rapturously received poems and stories and novels, this is what's real to her. The actual material circumstances of her life are matters she labors to avoid, striving to preserve the curtain that is always hanging between me and reality. And it turns out that the most effective curtain is drugs. The first shot of Demerol is so ravishingly beautiful that you read with pounding heart and clenched stomach, knowing addiction is coming, calculating the number of pages left and thinking, well, there aren't so many. How bad can it be? Very, very horrifyingly bad, as Tove knowingly, willingly deals away her dignity, her autonomy, her health, her daughter, almost her life. When it's over, when she's hospitalized and has survived the worst skin-crawling agony of withdrawal, something surprising happens. Tove thrives. For the first time in her life, she's in a safe, protected place where people care for her and about her, and she feels connected to them and doesn't have secrets. She is attached, so much so that when she's deemed well enough to graduate from a locked ward to an open one, she decides to stay where she is known. This is a book preoccupied with being known, and unknown, and unknowable. Tove's reaction when one of her uncles dies. I think about the fact that no one except Aunt Rosalia has known him or knew what he was really like. Echoes the lament that ends the very first chapter. My mother is dead, and there is no one to tell her story as it really was. From childhood, Tove dreams of meeting some mysterious person who will listen to me and understand me. I know from books that such people exist. Her hospital experience is proof that such people exist outside of books. And the Copenhagen trilogy is proof that no matter how far removed you may be from Denmark of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, when it comes to feeling seen and known and less existentially alone, the right book can be as good as a person. Our next article by Lee Haber, Hamilton Kane, Wadzani Moot, and Jashunda Sanders is titled Lit Up. The eight authors we celebrate here are not simply writing books, which itself would be a remarkable enough accomplishment. These astonishing women are using their words and their platforms, their power, to open our eyes, awaken our senses, and deepen our understanding of each other and the society we live in. We celebrate them, yes, for the stories they tell, but also for the work they do in helping to make the world a better place, whether through what's on their pages or through their activism. Changing the narrative. Under Lan Samantha Chang's mentorship, a new generation of writers has emerged. When Lan Samantha Chang was appointed director of the Iowa Writers' Workshop in 2006, she became the first female and the first Asian or non-white person to head the program since its founding in 1936. The four directors who preceded her were all white men, and while it counted among its student and faculty alumni such renowned writers as Flannery O'Connor, Robert Frost, and Raymond Carver, it had a reputation for insularity. That began to change under the directorship of Chang's writing teacher, Frank Conroy, but when Chang took over, her goal, she told O Quarterly, was to create a more aesthetically, culturally, racially diverse program in terms of students, faculty, and the kinds of writing considered for acceptance to the program. I was really interested, she says, in finding voices that would reflect our changing country. One such voice, the 12 Tribes of Hattie author, Ayanna Mathis, an Iowa grad and ex-faculty member whose book was a 2012 Oprah's Book Club selection, told us, in my cohort in 2009, which was early in Sam's tenure, there were only three black women, which was in itself unprecedented then. But by the time I left Iowa as a professor in 2018, the program was a much truer reflection of literature in this country. There were so many black students from the U.S. and other parts of the world, the Caribbean, Ghana, Botswana, Nigeria, etc., Latinx students, Asian students. Sam made it her mission to ensure the workshop drew the best and brightest, which can't truly happen if only one sort of person is admitted. Ya Gyasi, an Iowa alum and author of the novels Homegoing and Transcendent Kingdom, put it this way. Lan Samantha Chang taught me the importance of being fiercely protective of your writing life, of keeping the work central, even as other things start to make demands. I wouldn't have finished Homegoing without her. Chang also wanted to foster a climate not of competition, but of cooperation, which meant leveling the funding process so all students got the same amount of financial support. Previously, the amount of aid students received depended on what faculty thought of their work, but under Chang, that changed. She says that this was important to free people up to do more innovative work, to write what they really wanted to. The program began to encompass writers of science fiction and fantasy and other more experimental work. This was necessary, Chang felt, because Iowa is the first and in many ways a seminal creative writing program in the country, so it's essential we reflect not only America's growing diversity, but also the complex mix of writers and cultures that are now our country. One of those writers is Chang herself, whose novel, The Family Chow, published by Norton, is a harrowing, mysterious, and at times hilarious reimagining of the Brothers Karamazov. In it, a Chinese-American restaurateur in Wisconsin is murdered, and one of his sons is accused of the crime. Chang believes teaching has helped her grow as a writer. For this book, she says, "I was inspired by my students, freed by the gradual recognition that I no longer had to strictly adhere to all the rules of writing that had been taught to me by my professors." She says, "There's a cross-pollination of words and thoughts and ideas that takes place in our community that makes possible the evolution of a literary generation." Heroine of her own story. Isabel Allende is one of literature's foremost writers, but it's her dedication to women's rights that has truly transformed lives. Isabel Allende's biography reads like something straight out of one of her novels, the latest of which is Violetta, published by Ballantine. The heroine of the exotic epistolary tale is looking back at her epic life from age 100, having survived the Spanish flu, the Great Depression, a daughter's death, and much else. Now she's chronicling that expansive existence for her grandson from her deathbed. In real life, Allende will be 80 years old. She was born in Peru to Chilean parents, but when her parents separated, she returned to Chile with her mother and siblings to live with her grandparents. Allende was 4 at the time. She spent the next years devouring many of the books in the family library and developed a reputation for speaking up, even daring to argue religion and politics with her grandfather, a strict Catholic. Allende says she was a feminist by the time she attended kindergarten, though she didn't have a name for it. Decades later, in 1973, her cousin, Salvador Allende, then president of Chile, died in a military coup, and Chile's government fell to a dictatorship. By that time, she was married with 2 children and worked as a journalist for a progressive women's magazine that tackled such verboten topics as abortion, contraception, divorce, and domestic violence. In 1975, Allende was blacklisted by the Chilean government and forced to leave the country. It wasn't until 1982 that Allende published her debut novel, the first of 16, The House of the Spirits, which launched her legendary career, and in 1987 she moved to the United States with her 2 children, Nicholas and Paula. Just 5 years later, a tragedy prompted Allende, who'd remained an activist for women's rights, to double down on her efforts. After the sudden death of her 29-year-old daughter from a blood disease, Allende launched the Isabel Allende Foundation in Paula's honor. It has since been dedicated to supporting programs that promote and preserve the fundamental rights of women and children to be empowered and protected. Allende told us that we are trapped in a culture that is at war with women, who remain subjects of extreme violence around the world. The foundation, which is now run by Allende's daughter-in-law, Lori Barra, and financed by royalties from her book sales, invests in the power of women, especially the poorest, the most vulnerable, the most at risk. Allende says that their focus is threefold: on health, especially contraception and abortion rights, on providing education and life skills so that victims of poverty or violence can become self-sufficient, and on protection against violence and exploitation, because if you live in fear, how can you have a life? Allende is passionate about her foundation's work and is well-informed about unfolding events around the world that put women in harm's way. She admits that at times she gets discouraged by all the bad news, feeling that we are just a drop of water in a desert of need. But her daughter-in-law helps her keep it all in perspective, urging her not to think about the macro, but about each case, each name, each face the foundation helps. "We can't shrug off problems that seem insurmountable. We have to act," she says. "We need to exorcise the demon of indifference." In her 2021 meditation memoir, The Soul of a Woman, Allende writes what must be her mantra. "Feminism, like the ocean, is fluid, powerful, deep, and encompasses the infinite complexity of life. It moves in waves, currents, tides, and sometimes in storms. Like the ocean, feminism never stays quiet." Going home again. Scholar Imani Perry travels south to find the heart of America. With the exception of the South, American regions are often characterized as forward-leaning. The West and Midwest are wild frontiers of gritty innovation and expansionism. The East and Northeast are fast-paced centers of culture, commerce, industry, and opportunity. That leaves the South as the backward other, claims Imani Perry in her provocative perspective shifting South to America, a journey below the Mason-Dixon to understand the soul of a nation, published by Echo. In it, Perry re-examines that characterization, complicating it and calling it into question by reminding us that good, bad, and indifferent, the South is the birthplace of much of what makes America, America. The South is really the core of what the nation is, she writes, often the vanguard of where we are going as a country. Tell about the South, Faulkner famously enjoined in Absalom, Absalom. What it's like there? What do they do there? Why do they live there? Why do they live at all? With portraits of previously unheralded events and people rendered in exquisite detail, Perry answers Faulkner's challenge. She ingeniously structures her exploration of the South as a travel itinerary, moving state by state, city by city, interweaving tales of the American experiment. Her trips to lecture and to interview notables as well as regular folk traverse a broad swath, from Louisville to Atlanta to Washington, D.C. It was the places like these, Perry writes, that gave us the dollar store business model, Coca-Cola, FedEx, and HBCUs. Perry also observes that the South gets short shrift when it comes to progressive political movements. For some reason, she writes, folks want to act as though Black Power started in New York and Oakland, even though the Black Panther logo came from the Loudoun County Freedom Organization in Alabama, even though Huey P. Newton was born in Louisiana, Eldridge Cleaver in Arkansas. She points out, Black nationalism and Black secession and Black armed self-defense have always been a part of the political imagination of the Black South, from Martin Delaney through Nat Turner and Denmark Bessie. Born in Birmingham and raised in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Chicago, Perry is most adept at shifting our narrow misconceptions about the South through her penchant for research and attention to the nuances of histories in obscure areas. She writes about the Low Country, the Sea Islands embodied in the Gullah Geechee culture, where enslaved Igbo Africans conjured stories about escaping slavery by soaring away, later immortalized in Virginia Hamilton's The People Could Fly. Intermingling stories from her past with theirs, Perry relates how these coastal communities defied the expectations of the slave owners who left them to languish there by learning to fish and become water people, painting their ceilings haint blue, a combination of indigo, lime, and milk, meant to ward off ghosts by the tint of water and sky. Perry's exploration, based on interviews with Southerners, from taxi drivers to renowned authors and esteemed art collectors, dismantles tropes and stereotypes, revealing the South's hard-won wisdom and generosity of spirit. And Perry challenges our often simplistic geographic understanding of the American South by extending its borders to Cuba, the Bahamas, and Haiti for comparison and contrast. She asks us to revisit our preconceived notions of the region, not to forget its flaws, but to remind us that the South gave birth to much of the music, art, food, literature, and commerce that nourishes our souls and supports our way of life. Perry writes, critical theorist Walter Benjamin once distinguished between two types of storytellers. One is a keeper of the traditions, another is the one who has journeyed afar and tells stories of other places. But there is a third, and that is the exile. In this vibrant, revelatory book, Perry proves herself to be a radiant storyteller in all three modes, like Zora Neale Hurston, Alice Walker, and Nina Simone before her. The Other Side of Eden. Hanya Yanagihara's remarkable third novel dares the reader to reimagine the past and future. Published in 2015, Hanya Yanagihara's A Little Life is a story about trauma and the tangled relationships among four college friends in New York. It won the Kirkus Prize and was shortlisted for the Booker Prize and the National Book Award. Yanagihara is now back with To Paradise, another tour de force, melding the polished, realist tradition of Henry James and Joseph Conrad with our looser, genre-bending movement. Yanagihara rewrites history for the purposes of the novel, drawing on and subverting narrative conventions and defying our expectations about what's normal in terms of gender. She's written a symphony on the page. To Paradise is effectively three novels in one, set in different time periods, 100 years apart. There are recurring names of Charlie, David, and Edward, and the last names of Griffith, Bingham, and Bishop, with little or no apparent connection to one another. The corrupting influence of wealth and power is a constant, as is the influence of a grandparent. And in each, the concept of paradise is explored, but there the resemblance ends. In its first part, Paradise offers a daring take on the past in which, post-Civil War, the country is divided into the North, free states, the United Colonies, and the West. The tale unfolds in downtown Manhattan, where a rich and influential family, founders of the utopian free states to which New York belongs, reside. David, a grandson of the Bingham Patriots, suffers from an unnamed illness. He eschews an arranged marriage with a socially acceptable partner for an unpredictable relationship with a penniless music teacher. It's 1893, and gay couples are free to marry without judgment, but classicism and racism reign strong. There are clear echoes of James's Washington Square, though with the author's singular twist. Part two is set in both New York and Hawaii, with another unequal relationship at the center, this one between David, a paralegal, and his older partner, Charles, who runs a prestigious law firm. It's 1993 amid the AIDS epidemic, where the shadow of death lurks in thoughts and looks between friends. Each lesion or weight loss is noted. David also keeps a secret about his background and his father's illness in Hawaii, no longer the paradise of his youth. Part three, set in a dystopian 2093, compromises half the novel and is steered by two narrators, a young woman named Charlie, who chronicles her day-to-day existence in a New York that is staggered through pandemics and the severe effects of climate change, and her grandfather, a Hawaiian emigre, whose story is told in epistolary form. New York is eventually split into municipalities and zones where individual freedoms are severely curtailed and travel beyond its borders is prohibited. Hawaii is destroyed by the effects of adverse weather, a paradise lost. Quarantine camps, containment suits, and the restriction of movement are already familiar. Yanagihara changes the novel's landscape. What is different, we accept. What is familiar, we recognize. To Paradise resonates because of its exploration of human relationships and the dismantling of preconceived notions. Biases and hatreds lurk and linger, emerging periodically to remind us that while one form of discrimination may have been eliminated, others remain embedded in our institutions and cannot easily be eradicated. In the end, threads of prejudice bind all three parts, and yet To Paradise is rich with characters that live in love with few boundaries. Circle of Life. In Catherine Schulz's radiant memoir, Morning Loss Leads to Brave New Beginnings. In June 2015, the Supreme Court handed down a landmark decision legalizing same-sex marriage in the United States. For New Yorker staff writers Catherine Schulz and Casey Sepp, this meant they could wed, and in May 2018 they did, the conventional way in front of those who had helped shape us and filled our lives with joy. This celebration of the ordinary may be the most radical element of Lost and Found, published by Random House. This is Schulz's outstanding second book. Schulz has mastered forms that include personal essays, literary criticism, and reporting. She won a Pulitzer for an article on a potentially cataclysmic earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. Lost and Found is a memoir in three acts. Lost recounts the grief she experienced after the prolonged death of her father, a lawyer and refugee who'd fled the Nazis. Found charts her way back to joy under Sepp's tender hand, and ushers in a fresh chapter for the couple in Maryland near Sepp's parents, where amid their vegetable garden and a swath of wildflowers, they prepare for the birth of their baby in the depths of the pandemic. Schulz's 2017 New Yorker essay on her father's decline and death, When Things Go Missing, connected his absence with abrupt vanishings in all our lives, misplaced keys and baseball tickets, serving as a template for Lost and Found. Schulz felt unmoored after he was gone. A strange part of my experience about grief was just how utterly absent he was. The non-presence of him was omnipresent, she writes. The second section offers an ode to Sepp, who spent her childhood working alongside her parents on their farm, sorting scrap, stacking firewood, helping empty the trash and vacuum the carpets. She attended 4-H meetings and vacation Bible school. Raised a Lutheran, Sepp is a devout believer who studied theology as a Rhodes Scholar, the opposite of the urbane atheist, but culturally Jewish Schulz. And yet a transcendent passion for literature and philosophy drew them together. In Seb, Schultz discovered a soulmate. There are beguiling set pieces nestled in the third act, like Fabergé eggs, unlocking intimate remembrances. In August 2021, the couple welcomed a daughter. Schultz is acutely aware of how her family is reflective of broader seismic change. The frames of normie domestic life have opened up. As Lost and Found attests, sometimes paradigms shift seismically on front porches, amid church socials, in the quiet of a country twilight. Unfortunately, I've run out of time to complete this story this week. We'll finish it up on the Oprah broadcast scheduled for March 3rd. But I will go ahead and read you the remaining sections that we'll finish up next week. Our Bodies, Ourselves. Megan O'Rourke has written a call to arms in the fight for compassionate health care. The Soothsayer. Margaret Atwood is a visionary novelist, but as her new volume of essays, Burning Questions, published by Doubleday, underscores, she also has an uncanny knack for foreseeing what will happen in reality. Be the Change. Mesha Marin's day jobs are novelist and university professor, but she's just as passionate about her side gig teaching writing to the incarcerated. Margaret Atwood is a visionary novelist, but as her new volume of essays, Burning Questions, published by Doubleday, underscores, she also has an uncanny knack for foreseeing what will happen in reality. Be the Change. Mesha Marin's day jobs are novelist and university professor, but she's just as passionate about her side gig teaching writing to the incarcerated.
We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.